Chapter 6. Years later, when this period of internment was remembered by the people who were actually there, they saw it in two distinct periods, before the box and after the box. Before the box, the terrorists controlled the vice president's home. The hostages, even when not being directly threatened, mulled over the inevitability of their own deaths. Even if by some stroke of great good fortune no one shot them in their sleep, they now understood exactly what was in the cards, be it before their release or after. They would each and every one of them die. Surely they had always known this, but now death came and sat on their chests at night, peered cold and hungry into their eyes. The world was a dangerous place. Notions of personal safety were a fairy story told to children at bedtime. All anyone had to do was turn the wrong corner, and everything would be gone. They thought about the senseless death of the first accompanist. They missed him, and yet look how simply, how brilliantly he had been replaced. They missed their daughters and their wives. They were alive in this house, but what difference did it make? Death was already sucking the air from the bottom of their lungs. It left them weak and listless. Powerful heads of corporations collapsed into chairs near the window and stared. Diplomats flipped through magazines without noticing the pictures. Some days there was barely enough strength to turn the pages. But after Messner brought the box into the house, everything changed. The terrorists continued to block the doors and carry guns, but now Roxanne Koss was in charge. She started the morning at 6 o'clock because she woke up when the light came in through her window, and when she woke up she wanted to work. She took her bath and had 2 pieces of toast and a cup of tea that Carmen made for her, brought up on a yellow wooden tray that the vice president had picked out for this purpose. Now that Roxanne knew Carmen was a girl, she let her sit on the bed with her and drink out of her cup. She liked to braid Carmen's hair, which was as shiny and black as a pool of oil. Some mornings, the weight of Carmen's hair between her fingers was the only thing that made any sense at all to her. There was comfort in pretending that she had been detained in order to braid the hair of this young woman. She was Mozart Susanna. Carmen was the Countess Rosina. The hair folded and looped into heavy black ribbons, perfectly ordered. There was nothing they could say to each other. When Roxanne was finished, Carmen would go and stand behind her, brushing Roxanne's hair until it shined, then twisted into an identical braid. In this way, only for the little time they had together in the mornings, they were sisters, girlfriends, the same. They were happy together when it was just the two of them alone. They never thought of Beatrice, who shot dice against the pantry door in the kitchen with the boys. At 7 o'clock, Cotto was waiting for Roxanne at the piano, his fingers running silently up and down the keys. She had learned to say good morning, ohayo gozaimasu, in Japanese. And Cotto learned a handful of phrases which included good morning, thank you, and bye-bye. That constituted the extent of their abilities in each other's language, so that they said good morning again when it was time to stop for a break, or when they passed each other in the hallways before bedtime. They spoke to one another by handing leaves of music back and forth. While their relationship was by no means a democracy, Tato, who read the music the priest's friend had sent while lying on the pile of coats he slept on at night, would sometimes pick out pieces he wanted to hear or pieces that he felt would be well suited to Roxanne's voice. He made what he felt to be wild presumptions in handing over his suggestions, but what did it matter? He was a vice president in a giant corporation, a numbers man, suddenly elevated to be the accompanist. He was not himself. He was no one he had ever imagined. At 7:15, the scales began. On the first morning, there were still people sleeping. Pietro Genovese was sleeping beneath the piano, and when the chords were struck, he thought he was hearing the bells of St. Peter's. None of that mattered. It was now time for work. Too much time had been spent weeping on the sofa or staring out the window. Now there was music and an accompanist. Roxanne Koss had risked her voice on Johnny Skeeky and found that her voice was still there. "We're rotting," she had told Mr. Hosokawa through Gen only the day before. "All of us. I've had enough of it. If anyone is going to shoot me, they will have to shoot me while I'm singing. In this way, Mr. Hosokawa knew she would be safe, as no one could shoot her while she sang. By extension, they were all safe, and so they pressed in close to the piano to listen. "Step back," Roxanne said, and shooed them away with her hands. "I'm going to want that air." The first thing she sang that morning was the aria from Rusalka, which she remembered was the one Mr. Hosokawa had requested that she sing for his birthday, before she knew him, before she knew anything. How she loved that story. The spirit of the water who longs to be a woman, who can hold her lover in real arms instead of cool waves. She sang this aria at nearly every performance she gave, though she had never infused it with the compassion and understanding that she gave to it this morning. Mr. Hosokawa heard the difference in her voice, and it brought tears to his eyes. "She sings Czech like she was born to it," he whispered to Gen. Gen nodded. He would never refute the beauty of her singing, the warm and liquid quality of her voice that so well matched the watery Rusalka, but there was no point in telling Mr. Hosokawa that this woman did not know a word of Czechoslovakian. She sang the passion of every syllable, but none of the syllables actually managed to form themselves into recognizable words of the language. It was quite obvious that she had memorized the work phonetically, that she sang her love for Dvorak and her love for the translated story, but that the Czech language itself was a stranger which passed her by without a moment's recognition. Not that this was any sort of crime, of course. Who would even know, except for him, there were no Czechs among them? Roxanne Koss sang rigorously for 3 hours in the morning, and sometimes sang again in the late afternoon before dinner if her voice felt strong. And for those hours, no one gave a single thought to their death. They thought about her singing, and about the song, the sweet radiance of her upper register. Soon enough, the days were divided into three states— the anticipation of her singing, the pleasure of her singing, and the reflection on her singing. If the power had shifted away from them, the generals didn't seem to mind. The utter hopelessness of their mission seemed less overbearing to them now, and many nights they slept almost in peace. General Benjamin continued to mark off the days on the dining room wall. They had more time to concentrate on negotiations. Among themselves, they spoke as if the singing had been part of their plan. It calmed the hostages. It focused the soldiers. It also had the remarkable effect of quelling the racket that came from the other side of the wall. They could only assume that with the windows open, the people on the streets could hear her, because the constant screech of bullhorned messages would stop as soon as she opened her mouth to sing, and after a few days, the bullhorn did not come back at all. They imagined the street outside. It was packed with people. Not one of them eating chips or coughing, all of them standing to listen to the voice they had heard only on records and in their dreams. It was a daily concert the generals had arranged, or so they had come to believe. A gift to the people, a diversion to the military. They had kidnapped her for a reason after all. "We will make her sing more," General Hector said in the downstairs guest suite that they had taken over as their private offices. He stretched across the canopied bed, his boots nesting on top of the embroidered ivory comforter. Benjamin and Alfredo sat in matching chairs covered in enormous pink peonies. "There is no reason she couldn't sing a few more hours a day, and we will rearrange her times to keep them off their guard." "We will tell her what to sing as well," Alfredo said. "She should sing in Spanish. All this Italian, it is not what we stand for. Besides, for all we know, she could be singing out messages." But General Benjamin, despite his occasional participation in the delusions at hand, knew that whatever they got from Roxanne Koss was something to be grateful for.
"I don't think we should ask."
"We won't be asking," Hector said, reaching back to plump the pillows beneath his head. "We will be telling."
His voice was even and cold. General Benjamin waited a moment. She was singing now, and he let the sound of her voice wash over him while he sought a way to explain. "Isn't it obvious," he wanted to say to his friends, "can't you hear that?"
"Music, I believe, is different. That's what I understand. We have set this up exactly right, but if we were to push..."
Benjamin shrugged. He raised a hand to touch his face and then thought better of it.
we would wind up with nothing. If we put a gun to her head, she would sing all day.
Try it first with a bird,
General Benjamin said gently to Alfredo.
Like our soprano, they have no capacity to understand authority. The bird doesn't know enough to be afraid, and the person holding the gun will only end up looking like a lunatic.
When Roxanne was finished singing, Mr. Hosokawa went to get her glass of water himself, cool, with no ice, the way she liked it. Ruben Iglesias had recently mopped the kitchen floor and rubbed it down with a hard wax by hand, so that the whole room shimmered like light on the flat surface of a lake. Could Mr. Hosokawa say, picking up the pot of water he had boiled and cooled this morning for this very purpose, that this was the happiest time in his life? Surely that could not be the case. He was being held against his will in a country he did not know, and every day he found himself looking down the barrel of some child's gun. He was living on a diet of tough meat sandwiches and soda pop, sleeping in a room with more than 50 men, and although there were irregular privileges at the washing machine, he was thinking of asking the vice president if he could kindly extend to him a second pair of underwear from his own bureau. Then why this sudden sense of lightness, this great affection for everyone? He looked out the large window over the sink, stared into the mist of bad weather. There had not been poverty in his childhood, but there was a great deal of struggle. His mother's death when he was 10, his father holding on, broken, until he joined her the year Katsumi Hosokawa was 19. His two sisters disappearing into the distant lives of their marriages. No, that family had not been a greater happiness. The earlier years he had spent building Nansei were like a hurricane in his memory, a huge, overbearing wind into which every loose thing was sucked. He slept with his head on his desk most nights. He missed holidays, birthdays, entire seasons of the year. From his endless work had come a great industry, great personal gain. But happiness? It was a word he would have puzzled over, unable to understand its importance even while its meaning was evident. And so that left his own family, his wife and two daughters. They were the question. If he had not drawn happiness from them, then the fault was completely his own. His wife had been the daughter of his uncle's friend. The country was past the age of arranged marriages, and yet essentially, a wife had been found for him because there was no time for him to find his own. They sat in her parents' living room during their courtship, eating candy, speaking little. He was so tired then, always working, and even after they married, sometimes he would forget he had a wife at all. He would come home at 4 in the morning and be startled to see her there in the bed, her long dark hair spilling over his pillows. So this is my wife, he would think to himself, and fall asleep beside her. Not that things had stayed that way. They had come to depend on one another. They were a family. She was an excellent wife, an excellent mother, and surely he had loved her in his own fashion. But happiness? That was not something he thought of when he remembered his wife. Even as he could picture her waiting for him to come home from work, a drink poured, the mail opened and sorted, it was not happiness for either of them that he saw, but a kind of efficiency that made their lives run smoothly. She was an honorable woman, a dutiful wife. He had seen her read mystery novels, but she never spoke of them. She wrote beautiful cards. She was a comfort to their children. He wondered suddenly if he knew her at all. He wondered if he had ever made her happy. His happiness was something kept apart after he had come in from dinner meetings and there was time to spend with his stereo. Happiness, if he was right to use that word, was something that, until now, he had only experienced in music. He was still experiencing it in music. The difference was that now the music was a person. She sat beside him on the sofa, reading. She asked him to sit beside her at the piano. On occasion, she took his hand, a gesture so startling and wonderful that he could barely inhale. She asked him, "Do you like this piece?" She asked him, "What would you like me to sing?" These were things he never could have imagined, the warmth of a person and the music, together. Yes, her voice more than anything, her voice, but there were also her fine hands to consider. the bright rope of her hair lying across her shoulder, the pale, soft skin of her neck. There was her enormous power. Had he ever known a businessman who commanded such respect? More than all of it was the mystery of why she had chosen him to sit next to. Could it be possible that such happiness had existed in the world all along, and he had never once heard mention of it? Mr. Hosokawa remembered himself. He filled his glass. When he came back, Roxanne was sitting at the piano with Gen.
"I've kept you waiting too long," he said.
She took the glass and listened to the translation. "That's because the water is perfect," she said. "Perfect takes a longer time." Gen exchanged their sentences like a bank teller pushing stacks of currency back and forth over a smooth marble countertop. He only half listened to what they were saying. He was still trying to puzzle out his night. It was not a dream. He didn't have those kinds of dreams. The girl he had watched, the girl named Carmen, had asked him a question and he had agreed. But where was she now? All morning he hadn't seen her. He had tried to look discreetly in the halls, but the boys with guns kept corralling him back into the living room. Some days they were open to hostages wandering around, and other days they seemed to think life's greatest pleasure was nudging people backwards with a gun. Where was he supposed to meet her? And when? He hadn't asked any questions. Despite her clear instructions, he hadn't been able to go back to sleep after she left last night. He couldn't stop wondering how a girl like that had come through the air conditioner vents with criminals. But what did he know? Maybe she had killed people before. Perhaps she robbed banks or threw Molotov cocktails through embassy windows. Maybe Messner was right. These were modern times. Beatrice came up and gave Gen two hard taps on the shoulder, interrupting both Mr. Hosokawa's conversation with Roxanne and his own private thoughts.
"Is it time for Maria yet?"
she said, not wanting to be late for the soap opera. As soon as she had spoken, she slipped the damp end of her braid back into her mouth and began the serious business of nibbling again. Gen imagined a knotted tumor of hair growing in her stomach.
15 minutes, he said, looking at his watch.
Like so many other things, the beginning of the soap opera had become his responsibility.
"Come and tell me when."
"Is this about her program?" Roxanne asked. Gen nodded to her and then said to Beatrice in Spanish,
"I'll show you on the clock."
"I don't care about the clock," Beatrice said.
"You ask me every day. You ask me 5 times.
"I ask other people too," she said sharply.
"It's not just you."
Her small eyes grew smaller as she puzzled whether or not she was being insulted. Gen took off his watch.
"Hold out your wrist." "You're going to give it to her?" Mr. Hosokawa asked.
"Why?" Beatrice said suspiciously. Gen said in Japanese,
"I'm better off without it." Then he said to Beatrice, "I'm going to make you a present."
She liked the idea of presents, even though she'd had almost no experience of them personally. On the program, Maria's boyfriend gave her a present, a heart-shaped locket with his own picture inside. He put it around her neck before she sent him away. But once he had gone, she held it to her lips and cried and cried. A present seemed like a wonderful gesture. Beatrice held out her wrist and Gen fastened on the watch.
"Look at the big hand," he said, tapping the crystal with his nail. "When it gets to the 12 here at the top, then you know it's time."
She studied the watch closely. It was beautiful, really, the round glass, the soft brown leather band, the hand that was no bigger than a hair that did a slow and constant sweep across the face. As presents went, she thought this was the nicest, better even than the locket because the watch actually did something.
"This one?"
she said, pointing out one of the 3 hands. 3 hands, how queer.
"The minute hand on 12, and the hour hand, the little one, on 1.
That's easy enough." But it wasn't easy enough, and Beatrice was afraid she would forget. She was afraid she would read it wrong and then miss the show altogether. She was afraid she would get it wrong and have to ask Gen, in which case Gen was sure to make fun of her. It was better when he just told her it was time. That was his job. She had a lot of work to do, and all the hostages were lazy.
"I'm not interested in this," she said, and tried to undo the strap.
"What is the problem?"
Mr. Hosokawa said.
"Doesn't she like it?"
She thinks it's too complicated.
Nonsense.
Mr. Hosokawa put his hand over Beatrice's wrist to stop her.
Look at this. It's very simple.
He held out his wrist and showed her his own watch, which was dazzling compared to Gan's, a bright coin of rose-colored gold.
Two hands, he said, taking hold of both her hands. Just like you. Very simple.
Gan translated.
Three hands,
Beatrice said, pointing out the only one that seemed to move.
Those are the seconds. 60 seconds in a minute.
1 minute, one circle.
Pushing the big hand forward, 1 minute.
Mr. Hosokawa explained time, seconds to minutes to hours. He could not remember when he had last looked at his watch or wondered about the hour of the day. Beatrice nodded. She ran her finger around the face of Gen's watch.
It's almost now, she said.
7 more minutes, Gen said.
I'll go and wait.
She considered thanking him, but she wasn't sure if it was the right thing to do. She could have taken the watch from him. She could have demanded it.
Does Carmen watch the program? Gen asked.
Sometimes, Beatrice said. But then she forgets. She isn't true to it like I am. She has duty outside today, so she won't be watching it unless she stands at the window. When I have duty outside, I stand at the window.
Gen glanced toward the tall French doors at the end of the room that led out onto the garden. There was nothing there. Only the garua and the flowers, which were starting to overgrow their beds. Beatrice knew what he was looking for, and she was angry. She liked Gen a little, and he should have liked her because he had given her a present.
Take your turn, she said bitterly. The boys are all waiting at different windows. They're all watching for her, too. Maybe you should go and stand with them.
It wasn't true, of course. There was no dating allowed in the ranks, and that was a rule that was never broken.
She had asked me a question, Gen started, but his voice didn't sound natural, and so he decided to forget it. It wasn't as if he owed Beatrice any sort of explanation.
I'd tell her you gave your watch to me.
She looked at her wrist.
4 more minutes.
You should run, Gen said. You'll lose your spot on the couch.
Beatrice left, but she didn't run. She walked away like a girl who knew exactly how much time she had.
What did she say? Mr. Hosokawa asked Gen. Was she happy with the watch?
Gen translated the question into English for Roxanne, and then answered them both that there would be no way to tell if she was happy or not.
I think you're smart to give it to her, Roxanne said. She'll be less likely to shoot someone who's given her such a nice gift.
But who's to say what kept a person from shooting? Would you excuse me?
Mr. Hosokawa let Gen go. It used to be that he wanted Gen with him all the time in case he thought of something to say. But he was learning to find some comfort in the quiet. Roxanne put her hands on the piano and picked out the opening lines of Clair de Lune. Then she took one of Mr. Hosokawa's hands and tapped the notes again, very slow and beautiful and sad. He followed her again and again until he could do it quite well on his own. Gen went to the window and watched. The drizzling rain had stopped, but the air was still heavy and gray, as if it were dusk. Gen glanced at his watch, knowing it was too early to be dark, and found his watch gone. Why was he waiting for her? Because he wanted to teach her to read? He had plenty to do without taking that on as well. Every person in the room had a thought that was in need of translation. He was lucky to find a minute alone. A minute to look out of the window. He didn't need another job.
I have watched out this window for hours,
a man said to him in Russian.
Nothing ever comes. I can promise you that.
Sometimes it's enough just to look,
Gen said, keeping his eyes straight ahead. He almost never had the opportunity to speak in Russian. It was a language he used for reading Pushkin and Turgenev. It sounded good to hear his own voice managing so many sharp consonants, even if he knew his accent was poor. He should practice. It was an opportunity if one chose to see it that way, so many native speakers in one room. Viktor Fyodorov was a tall man with large hands and a great wall of a chest. The three Russians, Fyodorov, Ledbet, and Berezovsky, mostly kept to themselves, playing cards and smoking from a seemingly inexhaustible supply of cigarettes, the source of which no one was exactly sure. While the French could make out a few words of Spanish, and the Italians remembered some of their school French, Russian, like Japanese, was an island of a language. Even the simplest phrases were met with blank expressions.
"You're day so busy," Fyodorov said. "I envy you at times. We watch you, up and down, everyone needing your attention. No doubt you envy us doing nothing. You would like a little more time to yourself, yes? Time to look out the window?"
What the Russian was saying was that he was sorry to be another bother, another sentence in need of conversion, and that he wouldn't ask were it not important. Gen smiled. Fyodorov had given up the pleasantries of shaving, and in a little more than 2 weeks had come up with an impressive beard. By the time they were sprung from this place, he would look like Tolstoy.
"I have plenty of time, even when I'm busy. You know yourself, these are the longest days in history. Look, I gave up my watch. I thought I was better off not knowing." "That I admire," the Russian said, staring at Gen's bare wrist.
He tapped the skin with one heavy forefinger.
"That shows real thinking. So don't think you're taking up my time."
Fyodorov took off his own watch and dropped it into his pocket in a gesture of solidarity. He circled his great hand to enjoy the new freedom.
"Now we can talk. Now that we have done away with time."
"Absolutely," Gen said. But as soon as he said it, two figures walked near the wall of the garden holding up guns. Their jackets and caps were wet from the earlier rain, and they kept their heads down instead of looking around, the way Gen imagined they should if they were supposed to be watching for something. It was hard to tell which one was Carmen. From so far away in the rain, she was a boy again. He hoped that she would look up and see him, that she might think that he was watching for her, even though he recognized the idiocy of this. Still, he had been waiting to see her, and he felt better somehow, assuming it was her in the first place and not just another angry teenaged boy. Fyodorov watched Gen and watched the two figures outside the window until they had passed.
"You keep an eye on them," he said in a low voice. "That's smart thinking. I get lazy. In the beginning, I kept a count of them, but they are everywhere. Like rabbits. I think they bring in more of them at night."
Gen wanted to point and say, "That's Carmen," but he didn't know what he would be explaining. Instead, he nodded in agreement.
"But let's not waste our time on them. I have better ways to waste your time. Do you smoke?"
he asked, pulling out a small blue package of French cigarettes.
"No. Do you mind?"
It seemed that no sooner had he struck his match than the vice president arrived with an ashtray that he placed on a small table in front of them.
"Gen," he said, nodding politely. "Victor."
He bowed to them, a pleasantry he had picked up from the Japanese, and then moved on, not wanting to interrupt the conversation he could not understand.
"A wonderful man, Ruben Iglesias. It almost makes me wish I was a citizen of this wretched country so that I could vote for him for president."
Fyodorov pulled the smoke through the cigarette and then expelled it slowly. He was trying to find the right way to begin his request.
"You can imagine we have been thinking a great deal about opera," he said.
"Of course," Gen said.
"Who knew that life could be so unexpected? I thought we would be dead by now. Or if not dead, then regularly begging for our lives. But instead I sit and I consider opera."
"No one could have predicted." Gen leaned forward imperceptibly to see if he could catch sight of Carmen before she passed completely from view, but he was too late.
"I have always been very interested in music. Opera in Russia is very important. You know that. It is virtually a sacred thing."
"I can imagine." Now he wished he had his watch. If he did, he would be able to time her, to see how many minutes it took for her to go past the window again. She could become her own sort of clock. He thought about asking Fyodorov, but clearly Fyodorov had his mind on other things.
Opera came to Russia late. In Italy, the language lent itself to this kind of singing, but for us it took longer. It is, you know, a complicated language. The singers we have now in Russia are very great. I have no complaints about the talent our country possesses. But as I live now, there is only one true genius. Many great singers, brilliant voices. But only one genius. She has never been to Russia that I know of. Wouldn't you say the chances of finding oneself trapped in a house with true genius are remarkably small?
I would agree, Gen said.
To find myself here with her and to be unable to say anything, it is, well, unfortunate. No, honestly, it is frustrating. What if we were released tomorrow? That is what I pray for, and yet, wouldn't I say to myself for the rest of my life, you never spoke to her. She was right there in the room with you, and you didn't bother to make arrangements to say something. What would it mean to live with such regret? I suppose it didn't bother me much before she resumed her singing. I was preoccupied with my own thoughts, the circumstances at hand, but now, with the music coming so regularly, everything has changed. Don't you find that to be true?
And Gen had to agree. He hadn't thought about it in exactly those terms before, but it was true. There was some difference.
And what are the chances? Given that I am a hostage in a country I do not know, with a woman I so sincerely admire, that there would also be a man such as yourself who has a good heart and speaks both my language and hers. Tell me what the chances are. They are in the millions. This is, of course, why I have come to you. I am interested in engaging your services of translation.
It's nothing as formal as that, Gen said. I'm happy to speak to Miss Koss. We can go now. I'll tell her whatever you want to say. At that, the great Russian paled and took three nervous puffs off his cigarette. So massive were this man's lungs that the little cigarette was all but finished off by his sudden burst of attention.
There is no rush for this, my friend,
unless we're released tomorrow. He nodded and smiled.
You let me escape from nothing.
He pointed his smoked-out cigarette again.
You are thinking. You are telling me it is time to declare myself.
Gen thought he might have misunderstood the verb to declare. It could have other meanings. He could speak Russian, but his understanding lacked nuance.
I'm not telling you anything other than that Miss Koss is right there if you want to speak to her. Let's call it tomorrow, shall we? I'll speak in the morning.
He clapped a hand down on Gen's shoulder.
In case we are so fortunate, is the morning fine with you?
I'll be here.
Just after she sings, he said.
Then he added,
but without rushing her any.
Gen told him that sounded reasonable.
Good, good. That will give me time to prepare my thoughts. I will be awake all night. You are very good. You're Russian is very good.
Thank you, Gen said. He had hoped that maybe they could talk for a while about Pushkin. There were things he wanted to know about Eugene Onegin and the Queen of Spades. But Fyodorov was gone, lumbering back to his corner like a fighter ready for the second round. The other two Russians were waiting for him, smoking. The vice president was standing in the kitchen looking into a box of vegetables. Crookneck squash and dark purple eggplants, tomatoes and sweet yellow onions. He took this as a bad sign that the people who surrounded the house were growing bored with their kidnapping. How long did these crises ever last? 6 hours? 2 days? After that, they lobbed in some tear gas and everyone surrendered. But somehow these cut-rate terrorists had thwarted any rescue. Maybe it was because there were so many hostages. Maybe it was the wall around the vice presidential house, or their fear of accidentally killing Roxanne Koss. For whatever reason, their situation had already crawled past its second week. It was completely conceivable that they were no longer on the front page of the paper, or that they had already fallen to the second or even the third story on the evening news. People had gotten on with their lives. A more practical stand was being taken, as evidenced by the food in front of him. The vice president imagined his group the survivors of a shipwreck who watched helplessly while the last search and rescue helicopter spun north towards the mainland. The evidence was in the food. At first, it had all been prepared, sandwiches or casseroles of pulled chicken and rice. Then it came in needing some assembly, bread and meat and cheese wrapped on separate trays. But this was something else entirely. 15 raw chickens, pink and cold, their stomachs greasing the counter. Boxes of vegetables, bags of dried beans, tins of shortening. Certainly it was enough food. The chickens appeared to have been robust, but the question was, how did one effect the transformation? How did what was here become dinner? Rubén believed the question was his responsibility to answer, but he knew nothing of his own kitchen. He did not know where the colander was. He did not know marjoram from thyme. He wondered if his wife would have known. Truthfully, they had been taken care of for too long. He had realized that in these past weeks as he swept the floors and folded up the bedding. Perhaps he had been useful in society, but as far as household matters were concerned, he had become some kind of fancy lapdog. As a boy, he had received no domestic training. He had never once been asked to set a table or peel a carrot. His sisters made his bed and folded his clothes. It had taken a state of captivity to force him to figure out the operation of his own washer and dryer. Every day, there was a never-ending list of things that needed to be attended to. If he worked without stop, from the moment he woke up in the morning until he fell into an exhausted heap on his pile of blankets, he could not keep the house in the manner to which he had been accustomed to seeing it. How this house had sung just a short while ago. There was no telling how many girls came and went, dusting and buffing, ironing shirts and handkerchiefs, mopping the most imperceptible cobwebs from the corners of his ceiling. They polished the brass strips at the base of the front door. They kept the pantry filled with sweet cakes and pickled beets. They left the vaguest scent of their own bath powder, which his wife bought each of them for their birthdays every year, a generous round container with a fat down puff on top. Behind them in the rooms, and so everything smelled like a fistful of hyacinth sprinkled with talc. Not one thing in the house demanded his attention, not one object asked for his intercession. Even his own children were bathed and brushed and put to bed by lovely hired hands. It was perfect, always and completely perfect. And his guests? Who were these men who never took their dishes to the sink? At least the terrorists he could forgive. They were for the most part children, and besides, they had been raised in the jungle. At this he thought of his own mother, who would call to him when he forgot to close the front door. "I should send you to live in the jungle, where you wouldn't be bothered by things like doors." The hostages were accustomed to valets and secretaries, and while they had cooks and maids, they probably never saw them. Not only were their households run for them, they were run so silently, so efficiently that they never had to encounter the operations. Of course, Rubén could have let it all go. It wasn't really his house, after all. He could have watched the carpets molder in pools of spilled soda pop and stepped around the trash that circled the overfull wastebaskets, but he was first and foremost the host. He felt a sense of responsibility to keep some semblance of a party running. But what he soon found was that he enjoyed it. Not only did he enjoy it, he believed, with all modesty, that he had a certain knack for it. When he got on his hands and knees and waxed the floors did shine in response to his attentions. Of all the many jobs there were to do, the one he liked the best was ironing. It was amazing to him that they hadn't taken the iron away. If properly wielded, he was sure it was as deadly as a gun, so heavy, so incredibly hot. While he pressed the shirts of shirtless men who stood waiting, he thought of the damage he could do. Certainly he couldn't take them all out. Could an iron deflect bullets, he wondered. But he could clank down two or three before they shot him. With an iron, Rubain could go down fighting, and the thought of it made him feel less passive, more like a man. He nosed the pointy silver tip into a pocket and then slid it down a sleeve. He puffed out clouds of steam that made him pour with sweat. The collar, he had quickly come to realize, was the key to everything. Ironing was one thing. Ironing was within his grasp. But where raw food was concerned, he was at a loss, and he stood and he stared at all that now lay before him. He decided to put the chickens in the refrigerator, avoid warm meat, that much he was sure about. Then he went to look for help.
"Gen," he said. "Gen, I need to speak to Señorita Cos."
"You too?" Gen asked.
"Me too," the vice president said. "What is there, a line? Shall I take a number?"
Gen shook his head, and together they walked over to see Roxanne.
"Gen," she said, and held out her hands as if she hadn't seen them in days. "Mr. Vice President."
She had changed since the music had arrived, or she had changed back. She now more closely resembled the famous soprano who had been brought to a party at enormous expense to sing six arias. She once again put out a kind of light that belongs only to the very famous. Rubain always felt slightly weak when he stood this close to her. She was wearing his wife's sweater and his wife's black silk scarf covered in jewel-colored birds tied around her throat. Oh, how his wife adored that scarf, which had come from Paris. She never wore it more than once or twice a year, and she kept it carefully folded in its original box. How quickly Rubain had served up this treasure to Roxanne. He was overcome by the sudden need to tell her how he felt about her, how much her music meant to him. He controlled himself by calling those bare chickens to mind.
"You must forgive me,"
the vice president said, his voice breaking with emotion.
"You do so much for all of us as it is. Your practicing has been a godsend, though how you can call it practicing, I don't know. It implies that your singing could improve."
He touched his fingers to his eyes and shook his head. He was tired.
"This isn't what I came to say to you. I wonder if I may bother you for a favor."
"Is there something you would like me to sing?" Roxanne stroked the edges of the scarf.
"That I would never presume to know. Whatever song you choose is the song I have been wanting to hear."
"Very impressive," Gen said to him in Spanish. Rubén gave him a look that made it clear he had no interest in editorials.
"I need some advice in the kitchen. Some help. Don't mistake me, I would never ask you to do any work, but if you could give me the smallest amount of guidance in the preparation of our dinner, I would be greatly indebted to you."
Roxanne looked at Gen and blinked.
"You misunderstood him."
"I don't think so."
"Try again."
Spanish was to linguists what hopscotch was to triathletes. If he was managing in Russian and Greek, chances were he would not have misunderstood a sentence in Spanish, a sentence regarding the preparation of food and not the state of the human soul. Spanish was, after all, what he was translating in and out of all day. It was the closest thing available to a common language.
"Pardon me," Gen said to Rubén. "Tell her I need some help with dinner."
"Cooking dinner?"
Roxanne asked. Rubén thought about this for a moment, assuming he was not asking for help serving dinner or eating dinner. Then yes, cooking dinner was what was left.
"Cooking? Why would he think I know how to cook?"
she asked again. Rubén, whose English was bad but not hopeless, pointed out that she was a woman.
"The two girls, I can't imagine they would know a thing except for native dishes that might not be to others' liking," he said through Gen.
"This is some sort of Latin thing, don't you think?" she said to Gen. "I can't even really be offended. It's important to bear the cultural differences in mind." She gave Rubén a smile that was kind but relayed no information.
"I think that's wise," Gen said, and then he told Rubén, "She doesn't cook."
"She
Cooks a little, Ruben said. Gen shook his head. I would think not at all.
She wasn't born singing opera, the vice president said. She must have had a childhood. Even his wife, who had grown up rich, who was a pampered girl with most available luxuries, was taught to cook.
Possibly, but I imagine someone cooked her food for her.
Roxanne, now out of the conversational loop, leaned back against the gold silk cushions of the sofa, held her hands up and shrugged. It was a charming gesture, such smooth hands that had never washed a dish or shelled a pea.
Tell him his scar is looking so much better, she said again. I want to say something nice. Thank God that girl of his was still around when it happened. Otherwise he might have asked me to sew up his face for him, too.
Should I tell him you don't sew?
Gen said. Better he hears it now. The soprano smiled again and waved goodbye to the vice president.
Do you know how to cook?
Ruben asked Gen. Gen ignored the question.
I've heard Simon Thibault complain a great deal about the food. He sounds like he knows what he's talking about. Anyway, he's French. The French know how to cook.
2 minutes ago, I would have said the same thing about women, Ruben said.
But Simon Thibault proved to be a better bet. His face lit up at the mention of raw chickens.
And vegetables, he said. Praise God, something that hasn't already been ruined.
This is your man, Gen said.
Together, the three of them walked to the kitchen, making their way through the maze of men and boys who loitered in the great hall of the living room. Thibault immediately went to the vegetables. He took an eggplant out of the box and rolled it in his hands. He could almost make out his own reflection in its shiny skin. He put his nose to the deep purple patent leather. It didn't smell like much, and yet there was something vaguely dark and loamy, something alive that made him want to bite down.
This is a good kitchen, he said. Let me see your pans.
So Ruben opened up the drawers and cabinets, and Simon Thibault began his systematic inventory. Wire whisks and mixing bowls, lemon squeezers, parchment paper, double boilers, every imaginable pot in every imaginable size, all the way up to something that weighed 30 pounds empty and could have concealed a small-boned 2-year-old child. It was a kitchen that was accustomed to cocktail suppers for 500, a kitchen braced to feed the masses.
Where are the knives? Thibault said.
The knives are in the belts of the hoodlums, the vice president said. They plan to either hack us up with the meat cleaver or saw us to death with the bread knife.
Thibault drummed his fingers on the steel countertops. It was a nice look, but in their home in Paris, he and Edith had marble. What a beautiful pastry crust one could make on marble.
It's not a bad idea, he said. Not bad. I just assume they keep the knives. Gen, go and tell the generals we will have to cook our food or eat our chicken raw. Not that they would balk at a raw chicken. Tell them we understand we are morally unqualified to handle the cutlery, and we need some guards, 2 or 3, to slice and dice. Ask them to send the girls and maybe that very small boy.
Ishmael, Ruben said.
That's a boy who can take responsibility, Thibault said.
The guards had changed their shifts, or at least he saw 2 more young soldiers pull on their caps and head outside. But Gen didn't see Carmen. If she had come in, she was off somewhere in a part of the house that was off limits to hostages. Discreetly, he looked for her every place he was allowed to go, but he had no luck.
General Benhamin, he said, finding the general going over the newspaper with a pair of scissors in the dining room. He was cutting out the articles that concerned them, as if he could keep them in the dark by editing the paper. The television stayed on all hours, but the guests were always driven out of the room when the news came on. Still, they heard bits and pieces from the hall.
There has been a change in the food, sir.
Even though Thibault was the diplomat, Gen believed that he probably had a better chance of getting what they wanted. It was the difference in their natures. The French had very little experience in being deferential.
And that change? The general did not look up.
It isn't cooked, sir. They've sent in boxes of vegetables, some chickens.
At least the chickens were plucked. At least they were dead. It was probably only a matter of time before dinner walked through the door on its own. that their milk showed up still tucked warmly inside its goat.
So cook it,
he snipped a straight line up the middle of the third page.
The Vice President and Ambassador Thibault are planning to do that, but they need to request some knives.
No knives,
the general said absently. Gen waited for a moment. General Benjamin crumpled up the articles he had removed and set them in a pile of tight little balls of paper.
Unfortunately, that's a problem. I know very little about cooking myself, but I understand that knives are imperative for the preparation of food.
No knives.
Perhaps then, if the knives came with people, if you could requisition a few soldiers to do the chopping, then there would be control over the knives. It's a great deal of food. There are 58 people, after all.
General Benjamin sighed.
I know how many people are here. I would appreciate not having to hear it from you.
He smoothed out what was left of the paper and folded it up again.
Tell me something, Gin. Do you play chess?
Chess, sir? I know how to play. I wouldn't say I was very good.
The general tented his fingers and pressed them to his lips.
I'll send you the girls to help in the kitchen, he said.
The shingles had just begun to close in on his eye. It was clear, even at this early stage, that the results would be disastrous.
If we could have one more, maybe Ishmael, he's a very good boy.
Two is enough.
Mr. Hosokawa plays chess,
Gen said. He should not be offering his employer up for any services in exchange for an extra boy to chop, but the fact was that Mr. Hosokawa was quite brilliant where chess was concerned. He was always asking Gen to play with him on long flights, and was always disappointed that Gen could not last more than 20 moves. He thought that Mr. Hosokawa might enjoy the game as much as General Benjamin. Benjamin looked up. His swollen red face seemed to show pleasure.
I found a set in the little boy's room. It's good to think that they would teach the game of chess to so young a boy. I think it is a remarkable tool for character. I taught all of my children to play chess.
That was something Gen had never considered, that General Benjamin had children, that he had a home, or a wife, or any kind of existence outside of the group that was here. Gen had never stopped to think about where they lived, but wouldn't it be in a tent somewhere? Hammocks strung between the muscular limbs of jungle trees? Or was it a regular job to be a revolutionary? Did he kiss his wife goodbye in the morning, leave her sitting at the table in her bathrobe drinking coca tea? Did he come home in the evening and set up the chessboard while he stretched his legs and smoked a cigarette?
I wish I were better at the game.
Well, possibly I could teach you something. I can't imagine what I would have to teach you.
General Benjamin, all of the soldiers, had an enormous respect for Gen's abilities with languages. They imagined that if he could speak in Russian and English and French, he could probably do anything.
I would appreciate that, Gen said.
Benjamin nodded his head.
Please ask your Mr. Hosokawa if he would come at his convenience. There would be no need for translation. Here, write down the words for check and checkmate. In Japanese, I could trouble myself to learn that much if he would come for a game.
General Benjamin took one of the crumpled sheets of newspaper and straightened it out again. He handed Gen a pencil, and above the headlines, Gen wrote the two words. The headline he saw said, Poco Esperanza, Little Hope.
I'll send in some help for dinner, the general said. They will come directly.
Gen bowed his head. Perhaps it was more respect than was deserved, but there was no one there to see him do it. It would appear that all their choices had been taken away. Locked in a house with an armed teenage boy pressed sullenly against every door. No freedom, no trust, not even enough freedom or trust to deserve a knife with which to cut up a chicken. The simplest things, they believed, that they had the right to open a door, that they were free to step outside, were no longer true. But this was true instead. Gen did not go first to Mr. Hosokawa. Gen did not go and tell him about the chess. If he waited instead until tonight, what difference could it make? Mr. Hosokawa would never know he had delayed. There certainly was no one else who spoke both Spanish and Japanese to tell him. On the far side of the room, Mr. Hosokawa sat with Roxanne Koss, on the rosewood piano bench. Leave him there. He was glad to be with her. She was teaching him something on the piano, her hands and then his hands tracing over the keys. The stark, repetitive notes made background music for the room. It was too soon to say anything for sure, but he seemed to show more promise for music than he did for learning Spanish. Leave him there for now. Even from this distance, Gen could see the way she leaned against him when she reached the lower keys. Mr. Hosokawa was happy then. Gen did not need to see his face to know that. He had known his employer to be intelligent, driven, reasonable. And while Gen had never thought him an unhappy man, he had never thought he took any particular pleasure in his life. So why not leave this pleasure undisturbed? Gen could simply make the decision himself, and then Mr. Hosokawa could practice uninterrupted, and Gen could go back to the kitchen where Vice President Iglesias and Ambassador Thibault were discussing sauces.
"I'll send you the girls to help in the kitchen,"
was what General Benjamin had said. The words looped through Gen's head like the plucked-out refrain of Claire de Lune. He went to the kitchen, and when he pushed through the swinging door, he held up both his hands, a prize fighter after an effortless knockout.
"Ah, look at that," the vice president cried. "The genius boy returns triumphant." "We're wasting him on kitchen help and knives," Thibault said in the good Spanish he had acquired when he first thought he would be the French ambassador to Spain. "We should send this young man to Northern Ireland. We should send him to the Gaza Strip. We should give him Messner's job. Then maybe we'd get out of here."
"It was only a few knives," Gen said humbly.
"Did you get to speak to Benjamin?" Ruben asked. "Of course he spoke to Benjamin."
Thibault was flipping through a cookbook from the stack in front of him. The way his finger quickly traced back and forth across the lines, he appeared to be speed-reading it.
"He was successful, wasn't he? You know, Alfredo and Hector would have insisted on raw chicken. Better to toughen up the men. What did the good comrade say?"
"That he would send in the girls. He said no to Ishmael, but I wouldn't be surprised if he turns up."
Gen took a carrot out of the box and rinsed it off in the sink.
"Me, they hit in the face with a gun," the vice president said lightly. "To you, they give a staff."
"What about the simple coq au vin?" Thibault said.
"They confiscated all the vin," Ruben said. "We could always send Gen out for another request. It's probably locked up around here somewhere unless they drank it all."
"No vin,"
Simon Thibault said sadly, as if it were something dangerous, as if it were a knife. How impossible. In Paris, one could be careless, one could afford to run out completely because anything you wanted was half a block away, a case, a bottle, a glass. A glass of Burgundy in the autumn, at a back table at Brasserie Lippe. The light warm and yellowed where it reflected off the brass railings around the bar. Edith in her navy sweater, her hair pulled back and twisted into a casual knot, her pale hands cupping the bowl of the glass. How clearly he can see it, the light, the sweater, the dark red of the wine beneath Edith's fingers. When they moved to the heart of darkness, they had the wine shipped 2 dozen cases at a time, enough wine to quench an entire city through a drought. Thibault tried to make a cellar out of what was merely a wet dirt basement. French wine was the cornerstone of French diplomacy. He handed it out like peppermints. Guests stayed later at their parties. They stood forever on the walk that led down to the gate and said good night, but never seemed to leave. Edith would finally go inside and bring them each a bottle, press it into their resisting hands. Then they scattered into the darkness, each back to his or her car and driver, holding the prize.
"This is my blood,"
Thibault raised his glass to his wife when the guests had finally gone.
"It will be shed for you and for no men."
Together they would go through the living room, picking up crumpled napkins, stacking plates. They had sent the housekeeper home long ago. This was an act of intimacy, a pure expression of love. They were alone again. They were setting their house to right.
"Isn't there some kind of coq sans vin?"
Ruben leaned forward to look at the book. All of these books in his home that he had never seen before, he wondered if they belonged to him or to the house. Thibault pushed Edith's scarf over his shoulder. He said something about roasting and turned his head away to read. No sooner had he looked at the page than the door swung open again, and in came three. Beatrice, the tall one, Pretty Carmen, and then Ishmael, each of them with 2 and 3 knives apiece.
You asked for us, didn't you? Beatrice said again. I'm not on any duty at all now. I was going to watch television.
Gen looked at the clock on the wall. It's past time for your program, he said, trying to keep his eyes on her.
There are other things on, she said. There are lots of good programs. Send the girls to do it. That's always the way.
They didn't just send the girls,
Ishmael said in his own defense.
Practically,
Beatrice said. Ishmael reddened and he rolled the wooden handle of the knife between his palms.
The general said we were to come and help with dinner,
Carmen said. She spoke to the vice president. She did not turn her eyes to Gen, who did not look at her. So how did it seem that they were staring at one another?
We are most grateful, Simon Thibault said. We know nothing about the operation of knives. If entrusted with something as dangerous as knives, there would be a bloodbath here in a matter of minutes. Not that we would be killers, mind you. We'd cut off our own fingers, bleed to death, right here on the floor.
Stop it,
Ishmael said and giggled. He had recently received one of the amateur haircuts that had been going around, where his head had once been covered in heavy rolls of curls. The hair was now snipped with irregular closeness. It bristled like grass in some places and lay down neatly in others. In a few places it was all but gone and small patches of pink scalp shone through, like the skin of a newly born mouse. He was told it would make him look older, but really it just made him look ill.
Do any of you know how to cook? Ruben asked.
A little,
Carmen said, studying the position of her feet on the black and white checkerboard of the floor.
Of course we can cook, Beatrice snapped. Who do you think does our cooking for us?
Your parents, that's a possibility, the vice president said.
We're adults. We take care of ourselves. We don't have parents looking after us like children.
Beatrice was only irritated about missing television. She had done all of her work, after all, patrolled the upstairs of the house and stood watch for 2 hours at the window. She had cleaned and oiled the general's guns and her own gun. It wasn't fair that she'd been called into the kitchen. There was a wonderful program that came on in the late afternoon. A girl wearing a star-covered vest and a full skirt sang cowboy songs and danced in high-heeled boots. Ishmael sighed and set his 3 knives on the counter in front of him. His parents were dead. His father had been taken from the house one night by a group of men, and no one saw him again. His mother went with a simple flu 11 months ago. Ishmael was nearly 15, even if his body produced no evidence to support this fact. He was not a child, if being a child meant that one had parents to cook your supper.
So you know the onion,
Thibault said, holding up an onion.
Better than you do,
Beatrice said.
Then take that dangerous knife and chop up some onions.
Thibault passed out cutting boards and bowls. Why weren't cutting boards considered weapons? Hold the 2 edges firmly in your hands, and it was clear that these great slabs of wood were just the right size for hitting someone on the back of the head. And why not bowls, for that matter? The heavy ceramic in the colors of pastel mints seemed harmless enough while holding bananas. But once they were broken, how were they much different from the knife? Couldn't one drive a shard of pottery into a human heart just as easily? Thibault asked Carmen to mince the garlic and slice the sweet peppers. To Ishmael, he held up an eggplant.
Peeled, seeded, chopped.
Ishmael's knife was heavy and long. Which of them wielded a paring knife for self-defense? Who had taken the grapefruit knife? When he tried to remove the skin, he wound up cutting 3 inches into the spongy yellow flesh. Thibault watched him for a while and then held out his hands.
Not like that, he said. There will be nothing to eat. Here, give them here.
Ishmael stopped, examined his work, then he held out the butchered vegetable and the knife. He held the blade out to Thibault. What did he know about kitchen manners? Then Thibault had them both, the knife and the eggplant, 1 in each hand. Deftly, quickly, he began to peel back the skin.
Drop it, Beatrice shouted.
On calling out, she dropped her own knife, the blade slick with onions, a shower of minced onions scattering onto the floor like a wet, heavy snow. She pulled her gun from her belt and raised it up to the ambassador.
Jesus, Rubén said.
Thibault did not understand what he had done. He thought at first she was angry that he had corrected the boy on his peeling. He thought the problem was with the eggplant, and so he laid the eggplant down first, and then the knife.
Keep your voice down, Carmen said to Beatrice in Quechua. You're going to get us all in trouble.
He took the knife!
Thibault raised up his empty hands, showed his smooth palms to the gun.
I handed him the knife, Ishmael said. I gave it to him.
He was only going to peel, Gen said. He could not recognize a word of this language they spoke to one another.
He isn't supposed to hold the knife, Beatrice said in Spanish. The general told us that. Doesn't anyone listen?
She kept her gun aimed, her heavy eyebrows pointed down. Her eyes were starting to water from the fumes of the onions, and soon there were tears washing over her cheeks, which everyone misunderstood.
What about this? Thibault began quietly, keeping his hands up. Everyone can stand away from me, and I can show Ishmael how to peel an eggplant. You keep your gun right on me, and if it looks like I'm about to do something funny, you may shoot me. You may shoot Gen, too, if I do something terrible.
Carmen put down her knife. I don't think Gen started, but no one was paying attention to him. He felt a small, cold hardness in his chest, like the pit of a cherry had slipped into his heart. He did not want to be shot, and he did not want to be offered up to be shot.
I can shoot you? Beatrice said.
It wasn't his place to give permission, was it? It had not been her intention to shoot anyone anyway.
Go ahead,
Ishmael said, taking out his own gun and pointing it at the ambassador. He was trying to keep his face serious, but he wasn't having much luck.
I'll shoot you too, if I have to. Show me how to peel the eggplant. I've shot men over less than an eggplant.
Berenena. That was the word in Spanish, a beautiful word. It could be a woman's name. So Thibault picked up the knife and set about his work. His hand stayed remarkably steady as he peeled, with two guns pointed on him. Carmen did not participate. She went back to mincing the garlic, hitting her knife against the board in brisk, angry strokes. Thibault kept his eyes on the deep luster of the purple-black skin.
It's difficult to do with a knife this large. You want to slide it just under the surface. Pretend that you're skinning a fish. See that? Very fluid. It's delicate work.
All that was lovely about the eggplant fell into ribbons on the floor. There was something soothing about it, the way it all came out so neatly.
Okay, Ishmael said. I understand. Give it to me now.
He put down his gun and held out his hands. Thibault turned the knife, gave him the smooth wooden handle, and another eggplant. What would Edith say when she heard he had been shot over an eggplant, or turning on the television? If he was going to die, he had hoped for a little bit of honor in his death.
Well, Rubén said, wiping his face with a dish towel, nothing around here is a small event.
Beatrice mopped up her tears against the dark green sleeve of her jacket.
Onions,
she said, pushing the newly oiled gun back into her belt.
I'd be happy to do them for you, if at any point you deem me capable,
Thibault said, and went to wash his hands. Gen stood next to the sink, trying to decide the best way to phrase his question. Any way it was put, it seemed impolite. He spoke to Thibault in French. He whispered,
Why did you tell her she could shoot me?
Because they wouldn't shoot you. They all like you too much. It was a harmless gesture on my part. I thought it gave me more credibility. Telling her she could shoot me, now that was a risk. They care nothing for me, and they think the world of you. It's not like I told them they could shoot poor Rubén. That girl might want to shoot Rubén.
Still, Gen said. He wanted to be firm on this point, but he felt it slipping away from him. Sometimes he suspected he was the weakest person in captivity.
I hear you gave her your wristwatch.
Who told you that? Everybody knows she flashes it around every chance she gets. Would she shoot the man who gave her his watch?
Well, that's what we don't know.
Thibault dried his hands and looped a careless arm around Gen's neck.
I would never let them shoot you. No more than I'd let them shoot my own brother. I'll tell you what, Gen, when this is over, you come and visit us in Paris. The second this is over, I'm resigning my post and Edith and I are moving back to Paris. When you feel like traveling again, you will bring Mr. Ozakawa and Roxanne. You can marry one of my daughters if you want to. Then you would be my son rather than my brother.
He leaned forward and whispered in Gen's ear,
This will all seem very funny to us then.
Gen inhaled Thibault's breath. He tried to take in some of the courage, some of the carelessness. He tried to believe that one day they would all be in Paris in the Thibault's apartment, but he couldn't picture it. Thibault kissed Gen beside his left eye and then let him go. He went off in search of a roasting pan.
Speaking in French, Ruben said to Gen, that's very impolite.
How is French impolite?
Because everyone here speaks Spanish. I can't remember the last time I was in a room where everyone spoke the same language, and then you go off speaking some language I failed in high school.
And it was true, when they spoke in Spanish, no one in the kitchen waited for anything to be explained. No one was forced to stare vacantly while the others tore through unintelligible sentences. No one wondered suspiciously if what was being said was in fact something horrible about them. Of the six people in the room, Spanish was a first language only for Ruben. Gen spoke Japanese, Thibault, French, and the three with the knives had first learned Quechua in their village, and then a hybrid of Spanish and Quechua together, from which they could comb out the Spanish with varying degrees of success.
You could take the day off,
Ishmael said to the translator, a tough rubber spiral of eggplant skin dangling from his knife.
You don't have to stay.
At that, Carmen, who had been keeping her eyes on the garlic she was chopping, looked up. The nerve, which she had found so briefly the night before, had been missing all day, and all she had managed to do was avoid Gen. But that didn't mean she wanted him to go. She had to believe she had been sent to the kitchen for a reason. She prayed to St. Rose that the shyness which came down on her like a blinding fog would be lifted as suddenly as it landed. Gen had no intention of leaving.
I can do more than translate, he said. I can wash vegetables. I can stir something if something needed stirring.
Thibault came back lugging a huge metal roaster in each hand. He heaved them one at a time up onto the stovetop where each pan covered two burners.
Did I hear leaving? Is Gen even thinking about leaving?
I was thinking about staying.
No one is leaving. Dinner for 58, is that what they expect? I will not lose one pair of hands, even if the hands belong to the very valuable translator. Do they think we're going to do this every night, every meal? Do they think I'm a caterer? Has she chopped the onions yet?
May I inquire as to the state of the onions, or will you threaten to shoot me?
Beatrice wagged her knife at Thibault. Her face was wet and red from crying.
I would have shot you if I had to, but I didn't. So you should be grateful. And I chopped your stupid onions. Are you finished with me now?
Does dinner look finished to you?
Thibault said, pouring oil into the pans and turning on the bright blue flames of gas.
Go wash the chickens. Gen, bring me the onions. Saute these onions.
Why does he get to cook the onions?
Beatrice said.
They're my onions, and I won't wash the chickens, because that does not involve a knife. I was only sent in here to work the knives.
I will kill her.
Thibault said in weary French. Gen took the bowl of onions and hugged it to his chest. It was never the right time, or it was always the right time, depending on how you looked at it. They could stand there for hours, six squares of tile apart from each other, and never say anything. Or one of them, either one, could step forward and begin to speak. Gen was hoping it would be Carmen, but then Gen was hoping they would all be released, and neither seemed likely to happen. Gen gave the onions to Thibault, who dumped them into the two pans where they spat and hissed like Beatrice herself. Rallying the very small amount of bravery he still possessed, Gen went to the drawer by the telephone, which hung naked on the wall without its cord. He found a small pad of paper and a pen. He wrote the words cuchillo, ajo, chica, each on its own piece of paper, and took them to Carmen while Thibault argued with Beatrice over who was to stir the onions. He tried to keep in mind all the languages he had spoken, all the cities he had been to, all the important words of other men that had come through his mouth. What he asked of himself was small, and still he could feel his hands shaking. Knife, he said, and put the first piece down. Garlic, he set that one on top of the garlic. Girl. The last piece he handed to Carmen, and after she looked at it for a minute, she put it in her pocket. Carmen nodded. She made a sound, something like, ah, not quite a word. Gen sighed. It was better now, but only slightly. Do you want to learn? Carmen nodded again, her eyes fixed on a drawer handle. She tried to see St. Rose of Lima on that handle, a tiny blue-cloaked woman balancing on the curved silver bar. She tried to find her voice through prayer. She thought of Roxanne Koss, whose very hands had braided her hair. Shouldn't that give her strength? I don't know that I'm much of a teacher. I'm trying to teach Mr. Hosokawa Spanish. He writes down words in a notebook and memorizes them. Maybe we could try the same for you. After a minute of silence, Carmen offered up that same sound, a little ah, that gave no real information other than that she had heard him. She was an idiot, a fool. Gen looked around. Ishmael was watching them, but he didn't seem to care.
The eggplant is perfect, Ruben said. Thibaut, did you see this eggplant? Every cube is exactly the same size.
I forgot to take out the seeds,
Ishmael said.
The seeds don't matter, Ruben said. The seeds are as good for you as anything else. Gen, are you going to sauté? Thibaut said.
1 minute, Gen said, and held up his hand. He whispered to Carmen.
Have you changed your mind? Do you want me to help you?
And then it seemed the saint gave Carmen a sharp blow between her shoulder blades, and the word that was so tightly lodged in her throat disengaged, like a tough piece of gristle caught in the windpipe.
Yes,
she said, gasping.
Yes.
So we'll practice.
Every day.
Carmen picked up the words knife and garlic, and she put them in her pocket along with girl.
I learn my letters. I haven't practiced in a while. I used to make them every day, and then we started training for this.
Gen could see her up in the mountains where it was always cold at night, sitting by the fire. Her face flushed from heat and concentration, one piece of dark hair falling from behind her ear the way it was now. She had a cheap tablet, a stubby pencil. In his mind, he stands next to her, praises the straight lines of her T and H, the delicate sweep of her Q. Outside, he can hear the last call of the birds as they careen toward their nests before dusk. He had thought once that she was a boy, and it terrified him, this feeling.
We'll go over the letters, he said. We'll start there.
Am I the only one who has to work? Beatrice called loudly. When?
Carmen only mouthed the word. Tonight, Gen said. What he wanted then was something he could barely believe. He wanted to fold her in his arms. He wanted to kiss the parting of her hair. He wanted to touch her lips with the tips of his fingers. He wanted to whisper things to her in Japanese. Maybe if there was time, he could teach her Japanese as well.
Tonight in the china closet,
Carmen said.
Teach me tonight.